Good morning, everyone. Welcome to CSI.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for that introduction, Kath. Everyone, we're very glad to have you here for our Maritime Security Dialogue Series for 2018. Congratulations on the job. I know you've been in it for, what, just about 60 days?
It's about 60 days today, Peter.
So just the first question, if I may. You know, there's been a lot of information in the news lately about immigration, the crisis at the southern border. Two agencies that are sister agencies with you in DHS, CBP and ICE, have been very involved in that effort, received a lot of attention, a lot of national conversation. And then we've got the whole issue about yes wall, no wall. How much and how is the Coast Guard contributing to this integrated effort on immigration?
Sure, well, let me...
Integrated effort on immigration.
Sure, well, let me... Kathleen, thanks for the gracious invitation or invitation and introduction there. Peter, that's a great question, and the Coast Guard, I think, is very much part of that conversation. When you think about the southwest border and the challenges, sort of the politics around that, there's a comprehensive approach, I think, that's necessary here, and the Coast Guard falls into what I'll call the away game. Our sister agencies in the Department of Homeland Security, CBP, ICE, CSIS, there's a lot of agencies that touch the challenge set there, are focused a little more here close to the land border of Mexico. And that's a very difficult task. And there's a comprehensive solution that involves the terrestrial piece and the maritime piece. On the maritime piece, we're all about pushing the border out. So you'll hear me talk about, you'll hear sometimes the Secretary talk about, the maritime border is about 1,500 miles here from the southwest border. We're interdicting the drugs that come out of the source countries, predominantly Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia to some degree, but most of the cocaine destined for the United States comes out of Colombia. And what we do is we interdict those drugs before they hit the United States. Generally, they're first stop countries. They're destined for places like the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. When we interdict drugs at sea, and last year we took about 223 metric tons off the water. That's the Coast Guard working with partners. When you roll up the DHS numbers, they're bigger than that. With those 223 metric tons, there's about 600 smugglers that were involved in that. And when those drugs are stopped at sea, there's no violence. We're getting large quantities, generally a few hundred kilos to a couple metric ton type loads. But when those drugs do make landfall in those countries I mentioned, or places like Panama, Costa Rica, even up in Mexico, now it's a whole different dynamic. They're broken into smaller loads, there's a lot of violence. The violence, there's corruption, it just creates instability. So I say what we bring to the equation is the away game. We're pushing the border out. The Secretary talks about push and pull factors. The push factor is that instability, that violence, that challenge in governing that generally takes, you know, families with young children to push their unaccompanied children out to try to get a better life in the United States. So I like to think about it as sort of rheostats on a dashboard. You can turn up those rheostats with the capacity, the amount of Coast Guard that you throw against that problem set. What I've had the privilege of interacting with President Hernandez on, the Honduran president, he calls it the Maritime Shield. They've been able in Honduras to drive their homicide rate down over 30% in the last couple of years, and he attributes a large part of that to the work of the Coast Guard and partners that are stopping those drugs from reaching Central America.
Well, thanks. You know, to a guy with a Navy background, this whole away game and defense in depth really resonates, and sometimes I think that the discussion of the wall kind of brings you to point defense, and you know, agree that, you know, that's the bigger game. So appreciate that. And a related question, again on the Navy side, the Navy hasn't exactly been throwing assets at West Hem and Southcom, and the Navy up in the last few years has been aligned with a two-star Fourth Fleet, who's the Navy component,
correct,
to Southcom. And of course now the Navy's gonna switch that up and absorb Fourth Fleet back into Second Fleet and have all those assets on the East Coast under a single three-star command in Norfolk. It's a return to the past that you recognize. Do you think, or maybe it's too soon, but do you think there's a potential, if you put all the assets back in one pot, that there could be a better opportunity to source the interdiction requirements and work with the Coast Guard in the West Ham?
Well, I'll say this. We certainly welcome the Navy contribution. The Navy has been terrific partners with the decommissioning of the Perry-class frigates. As you know, Peter, that was a substantive loss to the amount of capacity we had down there provided by the Navy. Having been a recent J-3 at a COCOM, Southern Command, back in 12 to 14, or 14 to 16, you know, I see the demands that are on the Navy. Right now, as I look at the Second Fleet, the Second Fleet went away in September of 2011, if I remember right, and then CNO talked about bringing it back in May, and I think full FOC, IOC, you know, operating capability sort of this summer. I think they went away because we saw Russia through a very different lens or prism back in 2011. Now it's 2018, and we see a, you know, more aggressive, more assertive Russia. So I hope there might be ability to tap some of those, but my understanding of Second Fleet, it's from the Caribbean to the North Pole. When you really look at where most of the drug activity is, it's in the Eastern Pacific. 85% is on the left side of the Central American corridor. So my hope would be if the Navy can spin some capacity there, we welcome that. I'll put a law enforcement detachment on the back of any Navy ship. But that said, the Navy's pretty heavily subscribed, you know, with the challenges in the Med, with the South China Sea. So I'm guardedly optimistic. We have a great dialogue with the CNO, with the combatant commanders, and if they're ready to send some capacity, we're ready to put teams on board and put them to work.
Makes sense. I agree. They're still, they've reorganized in that direction to do a different thing.
I think so.
But it struck me that it was also sub-optimizing a little bit on the West Hem side.
Well, we're ready for them, and we're ready to partner up. And like I said, that would be fantastic. I'm a realist, but an opportunist if things present themselves.
Sir, changing gears, obviously the Coast Guard, I think, well, maybe not as obviously as you'd like, but I think there's good appreciation for what the Coast Guard is doing offshore. Certainly, really super positive national attention on the rescue efforts with the hurricanes and, you know, Coast Guardsmen and helicopters doing harrowing, you know, rescues. But, you know, one area of the Coast Guard's mission, which is the inland waterways, it's not as sexy, it's not as in the news, but I was checking some numbers the other day, you know, it's a hodgepodge fleet of tenders and barges whose average age is over 55 years old. So could you talk about your vision for the Coast Guard in that space and specifically about the waterways commerce cutter and the need for that?
Yeah, absolutely, Peter. I appreciate the question. It is sort of the blue-collar work of the Coast Guard here, and there's a system of waterways, the western rivers, the inland rivers, that allow commodities to move down from up in the Great Lakes down through the heartland of the United States. The economic engine of the nation's really fueled. It's about $4.6 trillion of revenue-generating activities that operate on what we call the marine or the maritime transportation system. The Coast Guard's got a critical role. We enable that. We set buoys on the waterways. We work the aids, the shore-based structures. We are captains of the port with their broad authorities, working through our sector construct. We have 35 sectors across the nation. They regulate in that space. So they work with the Army Corps, they work with the shipping partners, the full range. And I'd like to say we're a key enabler to that. The nation's economic prosperity is absolutely linked to that maritime transportation system. About 95% of all the commodities we buy off the shelves in our stores come in through one of the seaports. So you take the 350 ports, you take the inland waterways, you roll all that up, that's about $4.6 trillion of economic activity. 72 years old, actually maybe 73 now, is the oldest of those tenders, the Coast Guard Cutter Smilax. And we got to do better by our people. So where we're going is we're in the phase right now where we're assessing what's out there. Congress is very interested in this. The 2018 omnibus, the Coast Guard portion of that, put an additional $25 million above our small ask to get that program going. They put $25 million in there, and I think that's a signal to say America wants to get after recapitalizing those old ships, and there's sort of a growing recognition of the importance of those waterways. So we're going to press into that. I think by 2020, hopefully we'll have an RFP on the street and we'll start building some cutters, probably a fleet of 35. And there is a hodgepodge. We got a construction tenders, inland river tenders. We've got to figure out exactly what the right, you know, capabilities are, then what's the right match of those capabilities to the locations we want to home port those ships.
So you mentioned Congress, and recently the House Appropriations Committee reported out their draft bill on the DHS, and Correct. It did not have the Coast Guard icebreaker in there, $750 million, not there. So, you know, it seems like with the buildup we've had over the past couple of years, it seemed like we had some momentum, some mo to finally appreciate the fact that the Coast Guard really needed a new cutter. The whole situation with the Polar Sea, Polar Star, the age of those ships, the reliability, one of them which is laid up. It seemed like we had it. And in addition, you see reports like the Congressional Research report that just came out on the 27th that talked about the need for ships that could operate in this environment, the expanded water space there, the need for things like Coast Guard SAR and the Arctic infrastructure. What do you think? Is this, it just seems like have we lost this, or are we still in the game?
Well, let me take the first part of the question on first, Peter. I would say the appropriations process is a long process. And we're pleased that the President's budget for fiscal year 2019 included $750 million for Icebreaker. That should not be lost on it. That was an ask from the President. The Senate marked up their version of the bill, and there's still $750 million in there for a heavier polar icebreaker. The House, through some negotiations that their new Homeland Security Subcommittee Chair, Chairman Yoder, made some space for additional wall monies. That bill has to be conferenced. Some of the discussion in recent days has talked about maybe Homeland, because of the contentiousness, might be a post-midterm election type of bill to go to the, to actually get it to go to fruition or get over the goal line. So I'm guardedly optimistic. I think there's a strong interest in the administration. The Secretary of Homeland Security is committed to supporting us on the icebreaker. President's talked about, ships recapitalizing the Coast Guard at the change command and other places. So I'm going to take a guardedly optimistic approach that this thing has a lot of ground to cover, and there's still a lot of interest in getting an icebreaker to replace our 40-plus-year-old Polar Star, which is the only heavy icebreaker in the U.S. arsenal, which is Coast Guard. We got one medium science research-related ship, the Healy, but we need that ship now.
Got it. So just changing gears a little bit, you've talked a little bit in your early communications about readiness, and I'd like to ask you specifically about people.
Okay.
What do you see? I mean, you've kind of said that you're not going to look for some dramatic, we're not going to do a Williamson turn here on the direction and the course and track that your predecessor was on. But with respect to people as an asset, as the human capital of the Coast Guard, leadership development, do you have any early ideas of, about that and where you want to take the Coast Guard?
Yeah, absolutely. And what I've talked about is, I was a part of my predecessor's senior leadership team. So anything that is ripe for opportunities for betterment, I've got some skin in that game. That's a good thing. That presented the opportunity for really a continuity of command versus a change of command. Where we're going to go with people is, I framed some guiding principles. I use sort of three terms: ready, relevant, responsive. And my objective in my tenure is to deliver to the Secretary of Homeland Security, to the combatant commanders, to the maritime interests of the nation, the Coast Guard, it is ready, that we can get out there and serve and protect the American taxpayer, that we're relevant. We're the only armed service that's located in the Department of Homeland Security. We're the fifth armed service. We're a law enforcement agency, a regulatory body. We're a really unique instrument of national security when you roll that up. And then being responsive, it's about that biased action. So to the people question, an area I think we have opportunity to do better is linking the people needs to the readiness equation. Where we are is 2018 was a high water mark here for the Coast Guard. We're a $12 billion organization. We had a $2+ billion capital account in 2018. That's fantastic and very appreciative of the Congress for that. But we've been starved a bit on the operating side of the budget. Since the Budget Control Act of 2011, we've been a flat organization. We've lost 10% purchasing power. And that operating and support, O&M, O&S, whatever you want to call it here, there's some lexicon change with budgets going on. That's the place I got to press into. And that is really what supports your people. Things like healthcare, things like getting folks to professional development. We don't do a lot in terms of professional development. If you're a young enlisted sailor, you go to your Cape May, the entry training center, you go to your A school, to your apprentice learning, you get your trade, you get a dose of leadership there. We'll send you to what we call leadership and management training before you advance up in the ranks here to E5 or so, and then you don't get something to your chief petty officer. For our officers, we've just last couple of years been introducing this mid-grade officer course, but we're only touching a small part of the workforce. So we've got some opportunities, I think, to press up our leadership development, our professional development, our folks, and in the lexicon, that those three R's I'm talking about, I'm going to try to link that a little bit more to the readiness of the organization, Peter. We got fantastic folks. I mean, the best people we ever had. And like the other services, we just introduced something on 1 January called the Blended Retirement System. So that's a great thing. We've got men and women serving across the globe. Not everybody has it in their makeup to serve 20 years to get some type of a benefit, and nor should they. But for the Coast Guard, where we have the highest retention, I think, of all the services for our enlisted folks and our officers, we've got to be an employer of choice. We've got to understand what it takes to keep people motivated to stay in the Coast Guard, because about year 12, if they're smart savers, they invest in their thrift savings plan, we give them a match. An industry person from Shell Oil says, hey, you're a pretty skilled guy, Schultz. Your wife's got a good job down there. Kids are happy on the soccer team. What does it take to keep you here? So if we're not doing the right things and really thinking about the readiness of our folks and taking care of our folks, they're going to jump ship because they got a lot of skills. So that's sort of the paradigm I'm looking at the people challenge through.
Yes, sir. I'm going to ask one more question and then open it up to the audience to think about what you'd like to ask the Commandant. Just my final question before we open it up, sir, is so 60 days on station, you know, Coast Guard is a tight-knit, small organization. As you said, it's not like you came out from left field. You were on a close leadership team with, you know, Commandant Zukunft. But is there anything in the first couple months that now that you have the reins, that was a surprise or unexpected, or did you feel like you pretty much, you know, you'd already kicked the doors, slammed it?
I would say no real surprises. I would say you get to Washington, the icebreaker, and you brought the question up. The icebreaker's tracking, you're feeling pretty good, then suddenly, you know, the house mark doesn't have the icebreaker. And I am guardedly optimistic, but things change quick. It's a dynamic environment. I think one of the things that, as we talk about this ready, relevant, responsive Coast Guard, the demand for Coast Guard services has never been higher.
Right.
You know, we're talking to the Indo-PACOM commander, Phil Davison, about, you know, his needs out there, and there's requests for forces to support and augment some of the things going on in that part of the world. So we've got Coast Guard men and women supporting all six of the geographic combatant commanders every day. I think if I scribbled on a piece of paper, I probably got ships supporting five of those six combatant commanders, and I may have a law enforcement attachment working with the AFRICOM combatant commander doing some training with African partner nations on there on protecting their sovereign interests and protecting their, you know, their fish stocks and things like that. So we're a globally pressed, fully subscribed Coast Guard today. I don't think that surprised me, but now you're in the seat and you're trying to think about 2020 budget, pulling that into today, the 2019 budget. We're executing $835 million that Congress very generously gave us to make right from the damages from Hurricane Matthew in 2016. We didn't get funds from that in 17. And then all the damages our units experienced in 2017 with the bevy of hurricanes that we all know too well. And then there's a little extra money in there to help us be more resilient, to be ready for the future. So I would say there's a lot there. Before, I owned two-thirds of the operating piece of that. Now as a Commandant, you know, you got a little different perspective, but we built a terrific team. I'm really excited about the senior enlisted leaders and the 3 and 4 star team we have, and we're ready to get off to the races, Peter.
Sir, I believe you. I'll open it up to questions in the back. Kevin Wensing.
Hi, Admiral. Thanks very much for coming. Thanks very much for coming. Kevin Wensing, I'm a member of the Navy League and U.S. Naval Institute. You mentioned Africa and fisheries. I was going to ask if you could comment about what the Coast Guard does with partners, allies, friends, and maybe NGOs to support those kind of operations around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that, Kevin, that always amazes me about the Coast Guard is we partner from a single sheriff in a locality to the Department of Defense and the National Intelligence Committee and community, and that's a broad range, but we do that very well. We're Admiral Allen, my predecessor, a couple times removed, used to say we're jurisdictionally multilingual, and I think that's a real strength for the Coast Guard. But yeah, we'll have law enforcement detachments working. Initially, it was on gray hulls, Navy ships over there. We had sometimes a Coast Guard ship. Now we actually have them on host nation countries. We've had Coast Guard folks working on the Senegalese and the Ghanaian platforms. That's a win. That's their capacity developing. We work down in the Southcom AOR. Tradewinds is a big Caribbean-based operation every year. We send a cutter down there. We're involved in that. We're working. Rim of the Pacific is the largest maritime exercise. 24 nations is just wrapping up out there. And one of our national security cutters was one of the task force commanders out there a little bit. So I would say
Berthoff.
All over the globe, the Berthoff was involved in that. That's the first of the national security cutters. Those ships are fantastic. They're just proving their value every day on station. So sometimes it's small teams. Sometimes it's big operations like, you know, the RIMPAC and the Berthoff out there. We're working in Alaska. I'm actually heading up there later today via Californian. We're working with the indigenous local unit, you know, tribal folks up there as we look at the Arctic as an emerging, it's really not an emerging place. The reality of the Arctic is on us today. And we didn't talk, Peter, when we talked icebreakers, but, you know, I think my sort of evolving thinking is sort of a 6-3-1 strategy up there. We need 6 icebreakers, 3 of them needing to be heavy icebreakers. And then we really need 1 today. You know, we need to get going there. So all those things are places, back to your question about where do we touch different groups. With NGOs, it's a bit more episodic. I think we, if there was a mass migration, we train with Southcom every year on the potential of that in the Caribbean. NGOs get involved in that. It's a couple levels removed from the actual efforts on the water. So I think that's a space we work in. Not every day, but we're pretty wide base, globally dispersed, locally sort of sited organizations, the United States Coast Guard.
Okay, this gentleman had a question earlier. Get him in front. Wait for the mic, please.
Admiral Sean Planky. I really appreciated that talk about returning to East Coast operations with the Navy. You know, in the past, there were the maritime defense zones that helped push back against Russia or now, in this case, Chinese espionage vessels, as well as Russian submarines on the East Coast. The Coast Guard also owns the minesweeping capability, or the requirement for a minesweeping capability in U.S. ports as well. Do you intend to lean into this or look back to that maritime defense zone construct and a potential change in command and control?
Well, Sean, our model kind of evolved from a maritime defense zone to Defense Forces East, Defense Forces West construct. So my last job, I wore that Defense Force East hat, and we would partner with our Canadian partners, with our naval partners, get together a couple times a year and sort of look at the threats. Generally, we'd do a sort of a 3-step process. We'd do a tabletop, we'd do a full-scale exercise, we'd do kind of a bunch of get-together sort of staff-level meetings the odd year. So things are changing. I mean, am I currently looking at our port security role here in a domestic capacity? I'm not sure that's the thinking today. You know, we do have those 35 sectors I mentioned that are providing security in the seaports. You see men and women on small Coast Guard boats. You won't see them, but Coast Guard men and women are visiting the facilities. We're looking at, you know, are our facilities safe? Do we know what's coming in? Are the vessels coming in environmentally compliant? We do inspections on the vessels. If your grandparents were taking a cruise, you know, you want to know that if there's a fire in that cruise ship and they need to abandon ship, that there's a trained crew, they can launch their boat. So, you know, to the specific question about changing the C2 construct back to the MARDES model, no, that's not on my scope today. You know, the thinking is always cognizant and staying in tune with what's going on in the world, but I don't think we're there right now.
Okay, right here.
Hi, Admiral. Ashley Roki with Shepherd Media. I wanted to ask a little bit more about the migrant issue, especially as things in Venezuela are not improving and Nicaragua is not in a good place right now. What is the Coast Guard doing to prepare for maybe an influx of migrants, and what assets would you need to deal with this?
Well, I appreciate the question. I would say, yeah, the situation in Venezuela is pretty challenging, and in Venezuela has been sort of a slow cook, and I don't know the specific number, but there's more than a million and a half folks that have transited the border with Colombia, and the Colombians are supporting Venezuelans there. In terms of that problem manifesting itself up through the Caribbean island chain and us seeing indicators of that here, we're not seeing that right now. But we're paying attention to that. The situation in Nicaragua is obviously very, very challenging, very politically fraught. Are we seeing Nicaraguans presenting at the southwest border? I have not seen indications of that. I think we're seeing Nicaraguans moving into the neighboring countries, and it'll be interesting to see where that unfolds. In terms of preparation, we prepare annually through what we call the Integrated Advanced Exercise Series with DOD, with U.S. Southern Command. And every year we prepare for a mass migration. It's sort of, again, the full-scale exercise, tabletop exercise, senior leader type seminars. It's on a 3-year cycle. But I would say we're ready for that problem set any given day. That's right in our wheelhouse of expertise. We've got the partnerships established. The Department of Security is obviously a key part of that team, and I serve the secretary there, so it's fairly well integrated.
Okay, this gentleman here in the middle.
Wait, can you wait? I'm former CEO of Polar Research Laboratory.
Former CEO of Polar Research Laboratory in Carpinteria, California. We definitely need the icebreakers. Our friends the Russians have been in the Arctic since 1934 or 36. Ratio of about 10 to 1 is visits, and probably that's increased more since I had the laboratory in their attempt to help us with the Arctic. So I think you need more icebreakers. My question is, given the interest in the Arctic, two questions actually, given the interest in the Arctic, we had a convention in place some time ago, I think it was the Montreux Convention, about who does what and why and where in the Arctic, who participates. So is there such a convention still in place? And my other question was, given the potential for changes in the seacoast, at what point do you think the Coast Guard will need to modernize the navigation aids and to accommodate that change?
Okay. Well, the first question, in terms of the Arctic governance in the Arctic, we're very interested in that. And we work through the Arctic Council. We work through what's called the Arctic Coast Guard Forum. The Arctic Coast Guard Forum dates back to 2015. The Arctic Coast Guard Forum and Council are both populated by the 8 Arctic nations. Currently, Finland holds the chair of the Arctic Council and the chair of the Arctic Coast Guard Forum are the same. Well, we held that chair until recently here and turned it over to the Finns. They'll have the council for 2 years till 19. Iceland is next to take the chairmanship of the council. The Coast Guard Forum is a body that gets together. It's not truly resourced, but it's operationally focused, operationally oriented. This past cycle, it was about doing a search and rescue activity in the Arctic, an exercise. And over in Reykjavik, Iceland in the fall, we actually sent a 270-foot Coast Guard cutter under my former realm of responsibility to support that exercise. So it's about preparing for increased activity in the Arctic. You know, there's now expeditionary cruise activity where there didn't used to be. There's more water where there used to be ice. So there's increasing mission demand for the Coast Guard up there. We're very interested in those governing forums. I think we have a very strong voice there. China has declared themselves a near Arctic state. They're up there, I think, for the 9th consecutive year with the Shuilong, their icebreaker. They're now domestically building an icebreaker. So China is asserting themselves as an Arctic nation. You know, they're a Arctic observer in the formal forums, but they see themselves having just rolled out an Arctic strategy recently as a near Arctic state. So China is asserting their interest in the Arctic. Russia has got somewhere north of 40, 45 icebreakers. They're currently building a new nuclear icebreaker, I think with 6 or 7 following that. So Russia's deriving an increasing amount of their economic, you know, interest out of the Arctic, going back to old bases and reactivating them. So it's a competitive space. Secretary Mattis talks about, you know, cooperating where we can and compete where we must. I would say the Arctic is a place where we really are, it's about competition, and the Coast Guard's probably the most visible presence you will see up there, and that's going to kind of walk that 6-3-1. That one is now. It is no longer an emerging frontier. There's challenges in the Arctic. We need to project our national sovereignty, our interests, and we won't get up there soon enough from my perspective. You know, the second question I think was a little bit about potential water rise, sea level rise. I think we got to be aware of that. As we're taking these funds I mentioned from the Congress to look at facilities that were damaged, it has to factor into our capital plans, how we look at where we site Coast Guard facilities, and our smart folks, our engineers are looking at that as we look at Coast Guard infrastructure. In terms of the, I think your question specifically is about aids and navigation. We're not there today, but aids and navigation have a visit rate. You're out there to visit them. You know, I think it's no more than 36 months. You know, some are annual. Up in the Great Lakes, you go twice a year because of the ice. We'll factor all that into our thinking.
Admiral, you just mentioned that you're in a stronger position through having membership and leadership positions on bodies like the Arctic Council.
Yes, sir.
So how do you square the circle that we are not still a signatory to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea? Don't you think that equally there's a need with respect to the Arctic and several other areas to get on board?
Yeah, the UN Convention on Law of the Sea, I think there's been many, you know, attempts at looking at ratification here by the United States. my predecessors, I think, have generally come out and been, you know, overtly supportive. I think that's my default position. There's a bigger conversation. I mean, there has to be, I think, the interest coming out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I spent about 7 of my last 15 years working on Capitol Hill issues for the Coast Guard. And I think that conversation, we would welcome that conversation. I suspect the CNO and others would, but there's a lot of politics that has to be a priority for either the Senate and or the administration, generally both, if that's going to change. Would it change things in the Arctic? There's places on our outer continental shelf where, you know, I think being having ratified that would clarify,
yes,
by things. But that's probably a broader conversation that I'm going to leave to our political leaders to tackle here at the right time.
Okay. Here in the front with the blue shirt.
Thank you, Admiral. My name is Justice Bennett from Defense Systems Journal. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about maritime domain awareness, sort of whether that's priority for you at the Coast Guard, and how you can see the Coast Guard sort of improving or expanding its role in the future.
Yeah, I appreciate the question, Justice. You know, maritime domain awareness, it's a bit elusive, and when we talk about it a lot, we're trying to really focus on, you know, a common operational picture within the maritime domain. You know, we have requirements on ships over 300 gross tons that carry AIS, automatic identification systems. We see things right now with North Korea and violating UN Security Council sanctions, and ships go dark. They have means of, you know, turning off their AIS, their black boxes of sorts, and we're very interested in that. Domain awareness, when we have a good situation awareness of the domain, it allows us to partner with our Navy colleagues, with international partners. There's a finite amount of capacity, whether it's Coast Guard, whether it's Gray Hull Navy ships, and where do you allocate those against the biggest threats? And I think that domain awareness is really, you know, an enabler to help us be the most effective Coast Guard we can be.
I think, though, in the past, just to pile on that question a little bit, in the past, and you kind of touched on it, it became all things to all people. You know,
yes.
It was a bottomless well, and some sense of prioritization was needed. And it seemed to me like the direction the Coast Guard went in was to at least make sure that in the approaches to our major ports and, you know, getting it also related to cargo security, but in the approaches to ports, especially in the U.S., that was a big deal. I think it seemed to break down a little bit as you got further out, but as far as the priorities for that go, as far as you as the Coast Guard Commandant, where would you see the priority is for maritime domain awareness?
Yeah, well, I almost think it's a different discussion set today. So domain awareness is really, if you talk about threats to our port, you got to start with the cargoes, and where do the cargoes start? So it's really big data analytics. I was reading something yesterday that says the Chinese are now going to build a ship that's capable of carrying 22,000, you know, 20 equivalent units, TEUs here a little bit, 22,000, I think. You know, you kind of wonder where the ceiling is and how big those ships can get, but you really have to start looking at those cargoes. So if you're in Rotterdam and boxes come from different parts of Europe, and then, you know, through big data analytics, you can track that there's a small number of boxes, a single box coming from somewhere else. That's when you start to have that situation where as you start to track that box across the Atlantic. You know, in the past, I think MDA's talked about the ability to see ships and stuff like that. I think it's a holistic approach. So we have a team of what we call International Port Security Liaison Officers. They deploy for a very small investment. It's 60 bodies. They touch about 144 nations. They come by invitation, but they look at the security in those ports abroad. They offer suggestions. There's a process if a port is not compliant. We'll work with State Department, demarche that country. If the country doesn't get on board, ships flagged by that country, when they come to the United States, will not enter our ports. They'll have to be stopped outside our territorial waters and boarded at sea. That is an economic disincentive. So part of that is the cargo piece. We work closely with CBP, Customs and Border Protection, understanding that. In our seaports, you know, Peter, we spent a lot of money back in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s on different technologies, EOIR, electro-optical infrared camera systems. You can see so far with those. Different radar systems, you know, some of the targets that come into the ports are, if you're thinking about threats, there's the big ships that has a dangerous box, there's a small vessel loaded with explosives, and there's a lot of different ways to tackle that. I think we're having a little more holistic conversation about MDA today than we did yesteryear. But it's a complicated problem set, and the technology is evolving here by the minute. Bigger ships, more computers supporting the operations. I think the cyber domain, it walks you right into a question about the cyber domain.
It does.
You know, looking at cyber. We ride on the .mil domain with DOD, so hardening our own systems to protect information inside the Coast Guard, and as we work with the other services. Then there's the regulatory piece about creating a framework for the shipping industries, the ports, you know, that's common sense, that's not onerous, that doesn't, you know, slow down commerce here, because we talked earlier about that 95% of your commodities that we buy coming through the ports. You got to find that right balance of security and enabling that commerce.
Right, and unlike DOD, you've got a customer-facing part of your mission.
Yes, sir.
That deals with those commercial aspects that you just mentioned, and also just regular citizens who need to, you know, be emailing you and communicating all the time. So that presents a little different cyber challenge than even DOD has in some respects.
The thing I'll mention just about the ports, if I could, just the hurricanes really accentuate something I knew, but I didn't realize just how quick. So when you had Harvey hitting the Texas area,
right,
you know, that Colonial Pipeline, when you got to look at rising waters and potentially shutting down some of the nation's few key refineries, that Colonial Pipeline serves up the East Coast of New York City. When you're 3 days in a pipeline shut down, people in New York are starting to pay 50 cents or a dollar more a gallon. You want to kind of get the political engine sort of riled up. That's what does it. The ports are absolutely essential to the economic engine of this country. I was in Hurricane Matthew. I was on the phone with then Governor Haley, Governor Deal, Governor Scott. You know, Governor Scott, you got to get Canaveral open so we can get fuel in for the Orlando Airport. And you think about the tourist-based economy of Orlando Airport.
Right.
The ports are absolutely vital to this nation's economic well-being here. And it's a very short window before you have a deleterious impact. You're talking 24, probably more like 48, 72 hours. But it happens quick.
Agree. Other questions? How about over here, right there, with the glasses there?
Hi, Admiral. My name is Marisol Maddox. Just back to the Arctic. Given the U.S.'s fairly limited engagement in the space, given how consequential the security implications are, and kind of looking at our long-term strategic interests in the region, and then the growing presence of China and Russia, I'm wondering where you see opportunities for maybe like public-private partnership or other ways that we can be strategically engaging in that space, and then especially in ways that might be able to enhance our NATO alliances, and also Sweden and Finland, how we could be maybe doing more like joint military exercises or engaging around science or technology, just where maybe you see opportunities and maybe also like specific threats that stand out to you as well.
Sure, a lot in that question. I would say what we're doing today in that domain, so the Coast Guard Cutter Healy, our medium icebreaker, is in route the Arctic. They're going to support three phases of research science missions. They're doing work with NOAA. They're doing work with the NRO, National Reconnaissance Naval Research Office, rather, and they're doing work here at the end with the National Science Foundation. So we are partnered with other groups there. What we're striving for, when I talk about that 631, those six icebreakers, three at least that are heavy, is the ability to access the Arctic, the polar regions, high latitudes, you know, both the Antarctic and the Arctic on an annual basis. We're currently taking the Polar Star and using it annually to go down and do the McMurdo breakout. That's a keenly important mission supporting partners. Right now, when that ship comes back 40 plus years old, it goes to the shipyard, and we gear up for a good part of a half a year to get that ship ready to go one more time next year to the Antarctic. But we really need to be in those spaces all the time. In terms of partnerships, international partnerships through the Arctic Coast Guard Forum, that's really the vehicle. So we're working with the Swedes, the Finns, the Norwegians, the Dutch there. We're having the right kind of dialogues. I think the exercise I talked about off of Iceland here in September is about operationalizing, getting, you know, sort of some common thinking around common problems. We'd love to see the Arctic be a peaceful place and focus on the governance, focus on the environmental aspects. The indigenous folks up there are very much about preserving the environmental aspect. Saturday I'll be up there. I have not been there before. A lot of my senior leaders have. I got a couple folks on the team that were former 17th District Commanders, which is our Alaska base headquarters, but there are opportunities. So we're going to continue to explore those. There's a now element to it, though, absolutely a now element. We saw Shell Oil a couple of years ago that was going to try to extract oil from the seafloor, and you're only talking 100, 150 feet down. In the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. But what they found was, even having made about $4.5 to $5 billion investment, it's a tough place. And you talk about public-private ventures up there, you really have to have the right capabilities to get up there. And that's what we're focused on, that heavy icebreaker. I'm not sure what we're going to call that. You know, right now, it's the heavy icebreaker, the polar icebreaker. I think the paradigm has shifted a little bit. I'm having a conversation with my team about maybe that's the polar security cutter. I mean, that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about national sovereign interests up there. We're talking about competition. We're talking about the face, the Coast Guard being the face of that competition. And we've really got to press into that. And I hope with the the continued support of the administration and the Congress, we're going to be pushing icebreakers up there in the not too distant future.
Okay. How about right here, that second one here with the hand in the aisle there.
Good morning, thank you. Nanette Sadusky, I work on the oceanographer of the Navy staff. Admiral, I'd appreciate your perspectives on the importance of support to ICE operations for maritime safety and security. So for example, the great work the Coast Guard's doing as part of the National ICE Center with the Navy and NOAA. Thank you.
Yeah, it's an important mission. We're committed to that mission. Our C-130s get up there and work with that. I actually had a former oceanographer, Tim Gallaudet, who's the NOAA, acting NOAA administrator, in for lunch here yesterday, and we enjoy a terrific partnership there, I believe, with the oceanographer of the Navy and team, and with NOAA. Very important. You know, we sort of forget the history here of why we are up there flying and tracking the icebergs, and it's still a risk out there. So we continue to work in that very important space, and there's no diminution of our intentions on supporting that key mission.
Okay. Question in the back there, gentlemen.
Admiral, thank you very much for coming today. I'm Hunter Stiers. I'm Adjunct Affiliate for Maritime Strategy at the Center for New American Security. I was wondering if you could speak to your view of the Coast Guard's role, given Chinese so-called gray zone operations in the South China Sea, which predominantly, to a significant degree, involve the China Coast Guard. How do you view the U.S. Coast Guard's role, either in terms of direct action patrols and so forth, or in an advisory capacity to Southeast Asian Coast Guards?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not going to give you probably the answer you're looking for. Right now, we're in discussion with Admiral Davison and the Indo-PACOM Command. There's a request for forces out there. I think you will see some Coast Guard presence in that part of the world here. The question is, what's the right application of our capabilities against a very broad problem set? You know, you look at Oceania, you look at China asserting influence, checkbook diplomacy in places where there's not much tempering competing voice right now. The Coast Guard, I think, could bring some unique capabilities in building partner capacity in places like Vietnam. We have ongoing relationships helping the Vietnam Coast Guard establish itself. They're on a tremendous growth cycle, and we're very much working with them. You look at, the Oceania region, there's places there where, helping them protect their interests, tempering that Chinese influence, it's absolutely essential. So I think my suspicion is, and this is ultimately when we support a combatant commander with a resource, ultimately, we will shape the intended use, but the combatant commander will put that, he or she will put that ship to use, that aircraft, whatever it is, towards the problem set it's best suited for. You're absolutely right. The Chinese Coast Guard is sort of the enforcing arm in that area. They've invested tremendous money in number of resources and platforms in the Chinese Coast Guard, the Chinese government. The PLN Navy, since 2010, has grown dozens of ships. You sort of look at the growth of shipbuilding in China versus the United States. China is asserting their presence very actively, and there's now islands where there weren't islands, and there's airstrips on islands where there weren't islands, and talk of weaponization, some indicators of that. So there's a definite increasing assertion of what they think is their sovereign rights, and we're concerned about sea lines of communication, as the Navy is, the FON operations, freedom of navigation operations the Navy does. There's a role in there. I think we'll probably be on the cooperate to compete side of things. I think the Coast Guard may scratch the cooperate side of that itch a little bit, maybe partner capacity building, theater security cooperation. I think that's the likely place, but I don't want to shoot ahead of the target there. I think that's the Indo-PACOM commander's really ultimate utilization of a Coast Guard capability that I think you're likely to see here in the coming calendar year.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Over here with the bow tie there, Ben Warner.
Hi, Ben Werner with the U.S. Naval Institute. I was wondering if you could talk real quick about the offshore patrol cutter and kind of how that would fit into your future operations and sort of the need for that and kind of plans for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the offshore patrol cutter, if you're not familiar with the term, is going to replace our 50-plus-year-old 210-foot medium endurance cutters, of which we have, I think, 14 today, and our 13 270-foot, 30-plus-year-old ships, the famous class cutters. So we're really excited about that. We got $500 million in the fiscal 18 omnibus here for production on the first OPC, offshore patrol cutter, long lead for the second. The president's 19 budget includes $400 million for a second OPC, long lead time material for the third. We're hoping to award a production contract here this fall. And the shipbuilder, Eastern Shipbuilding, is talking about cutting steel here, you know, probably sometime late September, early October. So that ship is the number that's notionally in the fleet. We're talking about 25 of those vessels here. We're, with the support of Congress, there was monies in the omnibus for a 10th and 11th National Security Cutter. So those OPCs, the 25 OPCs, what was initially a program of record of 8, the Congress has been very supportive and likes what they see of the NSC. The OPCs was sort of the backbone of our whole fleet recapitalization from a capacity standpoint. So you'll have the 10, 11 NSCs, or 11 NSCs for sure. There's potential talk. The House mark that we talked about earlier actually had long leads for a 12th NSC. So that's very much a conversation that's on the minds of Congress. 25 offshore patrol cutters, and then we're building a fleet of 58 fast response cutters. So back to the OPC, though, it's going to be a tremendously capable ship. It can launch over-the-horizon boats. It can carry, you know, shipboard-launched UAS, unmanned aerial systems. It'll be able to probably take an MH-60 helicopter in the back, an MH-65 Dolphin helicopter. We're very excited about getting to go, you know, starting to cut steel on that here, and probably see that first ship on the waterfront sometime in 2021. And the acquisition strategy is 2 a year. That's our plans here. And with the continued support of Congress, we're off to the races on the OPC. Thanks for the question, Ben.
Okay, how about that lady over there?
Hello, sir. My name is Ifemu. Yeah, sorry, I can't stand up. I'm in a wheelchair.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
I'm studying political science at the University of Regensburg, which is in Germany. So my question is regarding the migration issue. How are you preparing for that, especially regarding the separation of the families? Because I've read some stories that people were sick and they asked for medical treatment, but the guards didn't give it to them, so they had to die.
So I'm gonna constrain my comments on the immigration topic to really the away game, you know, the push factors. Our department, our secretary is very focused on this issue, reunifying the families here a little bit. That's an ongoing conversation. The border issue is a challenging issue. It's a very politically challenging issue, but my colleagues in CBP, Customs Border Protection, Border Patrol under CBP, Immigration Customs Enforcement, you know, we need to manage our borders more effectively. So there's a difficult conversation, but I'm gonna kind of stay out of the politics of the question there.
Okay, how about this gentleman in the middle here?
Thank you. Good morning, Admiral. My name is Theodore Boymov. I'm an ANSUB graduate. A question I have is, how aware are you and the Coast Guard of the new and disruptive technology of small satellites? And is the Coast Guard planning to utilize the advantages of this technology? And if so, how?
Great question. We are doing some things with CUBE satellites. We're doing some things here in the Arctic domain, and we're working with our office. We have a research and development center that's up in New London, Connecticut. So we're doing some things. We're partnered up with DOD. You know, U.S. Southern Command has done some things with CubeSats, and we're using CubeSats potentially to help with communication capabilities in areas where communications aren't so readily available. So we are kind of nudging in on CubeSats. I wouldn't say we're deep into that space, but we are looking at how those can be enabling capabilities for our mission set.
Okay, time for maybe one or two more. This lady right here.
Good morning, sir. I'm Bethany Johnson with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. And my question goes back to the law enforcement capability you were talking about globally with the Coast Guard's role in kind of effectively bolstering other countries. And I was wondering if there's going to be any big push towards that, especially in the Africa region. We're seeing sort of an uptake in piracy again a little bit over this past beginning of the year. So if there's any changes that are going to be happening with that?
Yeah, great question. I mean, we are committed to this Africa Maritime Law Enforcement Partnership. We call it AMLEP, and that is building the capacity. We're over there on a couple surge phases. We're there for a few weeks. We come back. We go back over. We're doing that with our law enforcement detachments, what we call LEADETs. And my successor down at Atlantic Area, Admiral Bushman's looking at the possibility of maybe sending a medium endurance Coast Guard cutter back over to the African continent. We've recently transferred the Nigerians some former excess defense article 370-foot high endurance cutters, and we're exploring the possibility of maybe our cutter going over there, working with them. Those are difficult ships. They're older ships, and you have to have the capability to support those ships, but we would love to go over there and potentially partner with the Africans out at sea and work that African Maritime Law Enforcement Partnership closer to shore. They were doing 3-4 boardings a day. And when you really look at the potential surge of population on the African continent, you know, those protein sources, which come from the ocean in large part, it's going to be a very big part of the conversation here in the coming decades. So I think it's your question was, are we going to do more? I think right now it's steady state. What might look different here in the next year is we may revisit the African continent with a Coast Guard cutter, which we haven't done in a few years. That keeps our skill set in the organization high for future engagement there, and it's a way to potentially work with the Nigerians who have those former vessels and come out and maybe do some exercising together to help them be more capable with those ships we gave them.
Okay. Right here. I had her hand up earlier.
She's been very patient.
Hi, Admiral. Lauren Williams with Federal Computer Week. I want to talk tech a little bit. What are some of the Coast Guard's tech modernization priorities, particularly with regard to cloud? There's a big DOD-wide push with JEDI. Also, the Navy has talked a lot about its compile to combat software development pilot program. So I wanted to know if the Coast Guard is doing anything similar with mini clouds and just where you are in general with your implementation.
That's a great question. I'm not a tech guy. What I've challenged our team to do is to have that conversation. I'm watching, reading a little bit about where the Navy, with DOD is with the cloud. That's a big movement. And you sort of say, what is that next big technological advancement that really changes things, that allows you to find efficiency? So we're watching closely JEDI and what DOD is doing there. One of the things we're doing in-house is we're treating our CG6, our tech, our computers, more like other programs. We're defining requirements. We're putting the right staffing and governance in place to really get after it holistically. In the past, we've cobbled together, different applications to ride on top of the system. We recently transitioned to Windows 10, and it was a pretty stringent requirement to stay on the .mil network. We had to have that done, I think it was back in March of this year. And that pressurized the system, but as we looked at our systems holistically through that transition, we realized we had a patchwork of applications and things. So we've got some opportunities. Potentially maybe we're having that conversation about the cloud here in the next 4 years of my tenure. Absolutely. I'm challenging my team to say, hey, come back and tell us where you think that next big muscle movement, that big step is that could really make a difference. On those 50-year-old 210-foot ships, the 30-year-old 270-foot ships, we have issues with connectivity. And initially, we thought you could just buy more bandwidth and push it out there as a bandwidth problem. It's more complicated than that. It's the applications we have on there. So we're sort of taking a holistic look and sort of defining our requirements. Then there's the whole cyber piece of that. We're standing up, we just stood up a cyber command. My intention was to put a flag officer in charge of cyber command here this summer. Some other movements and other opportunities for assignments probably delay that 6 months or so here, but we're working that piece of it as well. So I hope that's responsive to your question. But I'd say there's a lot out there, and I've challenged my new senior leaders to say, tell me where we really want to maybe take some risk and take that big step that might change, be game-changing for us.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank the Commandant and congratulate you again.
Thank you, Peter.
On this incredible responsibility that you have. Thank you for giving us this time, because we know your time is precious, and we truly appreciate you taking all these questions. We also want to thank our sponsor, Huntington Ingalls Industries, for supporting the entire 2018 Maritime Security Dialogue series. So we thank our audience and you again, sir.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you.